back to Shattering Myths. And we've been talking about the various dogmas of humankind and the horror that they have inspired. And it's a good transition back into our analysis of Paul. And we still have Glenn with us. And I have countered the statements from atheists, humanists, secularists, for years, who will write and say, you know, that religion is the source of most intolerance, hatred, and killing, mass murder, wars in the world. You know, most, in fact, it's stated so often that religion is the cause of most wars that it is actually believed to be true. And other than today, where Islam is the cause for virtually every war on the planet, for most of human history, religion and war have been inseparable, but so have religion and politics. So you could make the statement that politics is the impetus of all war and be no less accurate.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the point I'm going to make is that in today's world, if you look back over the last 100 years, most wars, over, with exception of the, you know, the rise here now of Islamic malfeasance, until about 15 years ago, in the 100 years preceding that, the vast preponderance of wars and murder, mass murder, if you will, on a global scale, was the direct result of the imposition of socialist secular humanism.
Exactly, and atheists get very touchy. I have a favorite atheist talk show host who I like to point out that the vast majority of people killed in warfare during the 20th century were killed by card-carrying atheist socialists. It was Stalin and Mao who did the bulk of the killing. Hitler certainly wasn't an atheist. He may have been a Catholic, he may have been an occultic, but he was certainly wasn't had an atheist agenda, but Stalin and Mao certainly did.
Hitler, in Mein Kampf,
a humanist in a sense.
No, you know, and it's absolutely humanist, because not a lot of people have read Mein Kampf. You know, they like to just slather the Nazi label and assume that everybody knows what you're speaking of. Nazi, of course, is the National German Socialist Worker Party. And the Nazis had a Bible. They had scripture. The scripture was My Struggle, Hitler's Mein Kampf. And in Mein Kampf, there is a God. Hitler's the God.
Right.
It's just like in communist China, they had a God too. Mao Zedong was their God. In the Soviet Union, they had a God. Lenin was their God.
Right.
And if you don't think so, then you're just, your eyes and mind aren't open. I mean, it's they've turned caricatures of these individuals into mighty statues and mighty busts and mighty placards and billboards and shrines, and their words are etched in stone and handed out in books as if they were scripture. And the exact same mindset that turned men into gods in communist China and men into gods in communist Russia turned a man into a god, a divine figure in Mein Kampf in Germany. It was a humanist agenda. And the only god that Hitler cared about was himself.
Well, so the descendants of Adam and Chawa are still hearing, ye shall be as gods, millennia
exactly.
later.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at why Mein Kampf, first of all, Mein Kampf creates a religion. And Hitler is very systematic. He says that men cannot be effectively controlled. Humankind is lost without religion. So if you pull from them the established religions, and you put in a new mindset, that new mindset must be articulated and accepted as a religion. And so Hitler called his religion the Volksreligion, the people's religion, of which he was the leader. It's the reason that the only religious reference in Mein Kampf beyond Hitler's own religious positioning is to Mecca and to Islam, because he recognized that Muhammad did exactly the same thing. Muhammad talked about there being a providence, a superior force that had chosen him to be the leader, when in fact Muhammad was that God. And the same thing was true with Hitler.
Right, right. So,
and by the way, that's not new. If you look at the transition from the Roman Republic to Imperial Rome, it's the same exact thing.
Yeah,
the leaders
absolutely
merged with their gods.
Right. And it's no coincidence that Hitler had a solar symbol, the swastika, though it was backwards spinning.
Right.
It was still, there's always very often a tie into the solar phallic cultus, and that's the swastika is the solar symbol.
Right.
You know,
in Islam, it's the crescent moon, only because the pagan Arab religion was fixated on sin, capital S-I-N, the moon goddess, and also in some cultures, the moon god. And Allah, Alat, Manat, Al-Uzza, all of the top gods and goddesses of the Kaaba, the rock pile, to stone gods, were associated with the moon.
The lunar cultus and the Saturnian cultus.
Right.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, it's interesting that the moon is the lesser light that reflects the sun's light. And so it's used in Barashith, in the opening chapters of Barashit, to talk about the fourth day, that the greater and the lesser lights are both going to become visible as signs. And, you know, the religions of man have used the sun and the moon as their gods and goddesses.
Yeah. Astronomical
right.
symbols
right.
and sex symbols.
Right. And, of course, what have these men that turn gods chosen to do with their integration of religion and politics? What was Rome all about?
Conquer, murder, oppress, trouble, absolutely.
Yeah, go out and kill and conquer and steal for me. I mean, the Roman military existed to extract forced contributions for those that were subjected to its authority. You had to give them your sons so that they could impose your own sons on you to force you to surrender a substantial portion of what you could produce so that they wouldn't have to work beyond having the military might. You know, the same thing was true with the Nazis. The same thing was true to a large degree with the conquests of even the Soviet Union. And, of course, nothing could be absolutely more essential to Islam. Islam was literally created on that premise.
But politics and religion both fall under the heading of ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, politics, you know, uses the military and the sword, and the religion uses the pen, and it's the psychological operation. So you can look at this as ideologies trying to control people, whether they're trying to control them at the point of a sword, the muzzle of a gun, or, with the psychological operations of the pen under religion. And they're always joined at the hip. The power,
right.
You always use both. But ultimately, it's kind of ironic. Ultimately, the priests always end up controlling the kings. The pen is mightier. It's the religions, the kings always bow before the priests.
Yeah, it's interesting that for most of human history, the cleric has held either more power or equal power with the king. You know, in Egypt, the pharaohs were constantly trying to position themselves as favorably as possible with their priests so that the priests would endorse their rule. And when the pharaoh ran afoul of the mainstream of priests, they were chiseled out of the history of Egypt. Their cartouches were chiseled away, because that while we know the names of the pharaohs and we don't know the names of the priests had a better life, and the priests were the power pulling the strings of the pharaohs. It was a religious construct in Egypt, and an exception would be a place like Imperial Rome. In Imperial Rome, they did it slightly differently, and that is that the leader became God. He became the father, the pope, the head of the state religion which was imposed. But what they did is the highest ranking individuals under the Roman Caesars were the moral judges. Not a lot is studied or talked about this, but it wasn't the governors who had the most influence within Roman territories. It wasn't the judges who had the most influence. It wasn't the generals who had the most influences. It was the moral authority. And so every area had an individual who could make decisions based upon the imposition of Roman morality. And that became the religious arm, really, if you will, of the leader.
Right. They're both control mechanisms, but the politicians and the military and the law enforcement are obviously the form of a stick. The religious authorities can be, the religion can be made ideologically to seem like a carrot. You know, you have all the morality in there. So it's carrot and stick. It's control either way.
Yeah, let me give you an example that I would have thought would have been an exception today, where the dominant force in the world, the ideology that is dominant, is humanism, secular humanism, mm-hmm. socialism, and its moral code, political correctness. And you would say, but there are no priests in this regard, so it's the politicians who have more power. But that's not true. The priests now are academics. The priests are academics. And if anyone steps out of line of what is the imposed edict, what the pen has written about this moral code, the politician is humbled and crucified and brought down. If someone accurately depicts Muhammad inciting terrorism, encouraging his followers to kill, or engaged in perverted sex, if they accurately present him though in those ways, what are Muslims likely to do in response? I think we still have Glenn here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm still here.
They're going to not only kill the individuals who publish such depictions, but anybody associated with them indiscriminately, right?
Yes, I'm here if you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you, Glenn. You're...
Okay, good. That's what I had said. Yes, they're definitely going to kill somebody.
All right. What would happen in Protestant America back a few hundred years ago if somebody said something that was contrary to Protestant Christianity and they depicted their any aspect of their religion in an unflattering way?
They might have ostracized the person, railed against him, but they would not have killed him. They would have considered him potentially a pariah, but I don't even think they would have beaten him up.
Yeah, with exception of places like Salem, where they would have killed you. During the time that Roman Catholicism was able to impose its will, where the cleric was more powerful than the king for a better part of 1,000 years and throughout Europe. If you were, even if your statement was 100% accurate and you depicted, for example, a distinction between what the Roman Catholic Church was saying and what is actually said in the book that they claim authorizes them, what would they have done to you?
Torture. They like torture. They wouldn't necessarily kill, but they might kill you. But, you know, certainly you'd be, you know, tased 27 times for defying the authority.
Yeah, you'd be. And they really developed some exquisite torture implements, did they not?
Yeah, I've seen, one of the museums of which you speak in Germany. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
And, of course, being a teenager, you're always interested in the chastity belts. But there were all kinds of other interesting things, too.
Of course, yeah. All designed to inflict the maximum amount of agony over the maximum amount of time. Today in an Islamic country, for example, let's take Saudi Arabia. If you're a blogger and you question the influence of Islam in any way, like the, for example, that's its abuse of women in your country, what do they do to you?
They'd kill you, generally, because you questioned you.
Yeah, in fact, their preference is to do what they're doing to the current blogger, which is 1,000 lashings, 100 at a time, so that you can heal between the bouts of lashings, so that they can make certain that they impart the maximum amount of agony.
Right.
And his crime, of course, was insulting Islam. When clerics rise to power, as they do and as they have in Saudi Arabia and countries like this, and they did throughout Europe for 1,000 years, when clerics rise in power, are they ever accepting of an alternative view?
No, they're quite rigid and dogmatic.
Okay, let's say that in America today, since one of the prime directives of socialist secular humanism, the ideology and political correctness, is to accept homosexuality as a cause célèbre, as something that is not only good but enlightened. If I were to say that I don't care if you want to be a homosexual, that's your business, but don't speak of it as being normal because it represents 2% of the population and therefore by definition is abnormal, what would they do if I make that statement in a forum that they have some influence over?
I get accused of hate crime and stuff. The word homosexual is actually not allowed in Britain, as I am understanding now, or at least they're trying to disallow it, even though it's the most accurately descriptive term. But you would be you'd be told you can't say that. You're intolerant. That's hate speech, and you're to be sanctioned. They can try and influence your employer to terminate you. They, all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And so the religious class today, the ideologues today, those with the pen that actually have more influence than do the politicians, because they absolutely control what the politicians can say and do. And they're crucified.
Amen.
We'll be back. Glenn, I want to have your comments. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Remember when Newt Gingrich had the lead among Republican candidates to run against the Obamanator? And he was quoted on an issue relative to Israel, saying that just speaking about and asking a question where the term Palestinian is used and Palestine and two-state solution suggests that you don't know the history of the region. You know, there is no such thing as a Palestinian. There is no such place as Palestine. And, you know, if we're going to have an intelligent discussion about this, we really ought to do so truthfully. And because that was outside of the bounds of political correctness, he was publicly destroyed. Politically destroyed. So there is a power, Glenn, that is above politics today. A priesthood using the pen for this ideology called socialist secular humanism that actually prevents politicians from doing anything other than the ideology dictates. Would you agree? And who is that?
Well,
new priesthood.
Well, the priesthood, I guess it would have to be the ones you're referring to, the social secular humanists. There's, I think, more than one, but they seem to be the overarching power. And while they're priests, when you say they're priests or academics, people think of college professors with PhDs, but let's not forget the school teachers being in this role over much more impressionable.
I actually think the educational system has become the new seminary. And by the way, was what Adam Weishaupt was one smart dude. You know, he's the fellow that is probably most responsible for the creation of socialist secular humanism. And he created it as a replacement religion because he was opposed to clerics being able to bequeath kingdoms to kings, and he wanted enlightened individuals to rule as opposed to religiously sanctioned kings. And so his enemy was Roman Catholicism, and his ally was himself, because he thought himself to be the most enlightened. And he created what we now know as political correctness and socialist secular humanism. And what he said is that the single most effective way that we can promote this is to control academia.
Right.
And we'll make academia the new seminary.
Right, because the targeting of the youth is a perennial goal. I mean, I remember a preacher preaching a sermon one time about an army being on the march, taking over, and he was referring to the army of youth that basically intergenerationally the young are always going to take over. So if you can brainwash the young, eventually the parents, the previous generation will die off and you'll have your new ideology in place by default.
In fact, homosexuality is so important for secular humanism. If you look at what they have done in terms of advancing the noble character of and the goodness of homosexuality, if you go back 20 to 30 years and you take a poll of Americans or read the polls taken of Americans 20 or 30 years ago, about 90% of Americans were opposed to homosexual marriage. The same poll you take today, and about 70% of Americans are in favor of it. And the difference is the indoctrination in the ideological seminaries of the socialist secular humanists, which is schools, universities in particular, but all through school. They have indoctrinated a generation to accept their moral standard.
Right, which is very anti-human, because you end up with... You need, you know, about two children per family to keep a society at level in terms of population.
The socialist secular humanists, they're interesting in two ways. First, you know, they're the highest order of things, and so they want collectivism, but they don't want to share. It's really an interesting conflict. They talk about shared everything, communist. Socialist, but they really don't want to share it. Most of them want a planet with a lot fewer people.
Mm-hmm.
They'd prefer a planet with 10 to 20% of its present population, and they don't want to share.
Right. Well, Ted Turner with his five children, you know, saying that you shouldn't have any, you know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, look what happened in communist China, where they made it illegal to have more than one child. We want to have fewer people, because since we're the epitome of all that there is, the fewer people, the fewer we have to share the wealth with.
And they market this through the media. The other priests are the media. You talk about one child. There's an old Blood, Sweat, and Tears song that was very catchy, you know. When I'm dead and gone, there'll be one child born.
Yeah, that's the church and mosque. Yeah, it's the church and mosque of the new priesthood, academia being the seminary and the priesthood, the professors being the priesthood. The new church and mosque is the media, to which people bow and pray, and they show their devotion, to which they spend inordinate amount of their time listening to the message of the cleric. And
but,
why
don't you ever complain about Katy Perry being the beautiful whore who rides the beast at the Super Bowl halftime show?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I just read a statement, came across the news wire, that Franklin Graham, son of Billy Graham, who was a 33rd degree Freemason, which means that he was not actually what he lured people into. You can't be a 33rd degree Freemason and be a Christian. They're in conflict with one another. And yet he lured people into Christianity through his tent revival meetings and salvation through the gospel of grace. His son, Franklin Graham, just announced today, get involved in Christians. Get involved in politics because gays and lesbians are. Think about how twisted that is. What he's doing, first of all, he's trying to integrate religion and politics. Back to the same thing we've been talking about there. They become one and the same, Christian and politics, political and faith. But he's now positioning gays and lesbians as their foe. I mean, how in the world could you be so twisted that the foe of your religion are gays and lesbians, and the way to confront the foe of your religion is to engage not in religion but in politics?
You know, and it's one thing I always think of is, you know, Yahushua said, don't not to swear oaths. Okay, he said, don't swear by heaven, you know, it's God's throne, don't swear by the earth, it's his footstool. Let your yes be yes and your no be no, and anything else comes of evil. Well, mm-hmm. you can't work your way up in the Freemasons without taking oaths.
Correct.
You can't take a political office without taking an oath.
Correct.
And even to have Christians put their hand on a Bible which says not to swear oath and raise their right hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Right. Taking an oath.
Right. What Yahushua says right in the book.
Right. You want to play in the military, you've got to swear an oath too, don't you?
Yeah, swear an oath. So Yahushua said not to do this. He said, let your yes be yes, your no be no, and all else comes of evil. How many of us pay attention to that?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's this very twisted world right now where there is no distinction between religion and politics, and where the battle lines are drawn on very peculiar areas. I mean, can you imagine being a noted Christian and telling your followers that you need to get involved in politics because gays and lesbians are, that a sexual preference by some 2% of the population needs to be thwarted by your engagement in politics and they are your foe?
Well, yeah, well, if you're
weird.
And you're pro-life, anti-abortion, it's not the homosexuals who are murdering babies, so for starters. So that's always one thing to look at. But aside from that, we have a lot bigger fish to fry, generally speaking. Well, I've argued, one thing, I consider the homosexual argument, disagreement, to be an ethical one, okay? It's not about genetics. It's a matter of ethics, okay? Yahweh says that, the man and the woman are made for each other.
Right.
You know? And so, yes, I disagree with that. But generally speaking, you know, the gays aren't the ones bringing the worst evils to our society. You know, I mean, there are homosexual couples that are adopting children and raising the child, and the child ends up being straight.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it's a...
The only thing that bothers, I only have one issue with homosexuality. There's only one. And that's this very issue that Franklin Graham is exacerbating, which is that homosexuality has become the darling of political correctness. It is the litmus test. It is their circumcision.
Right.
And
you're not allowed to contradict
it. Right. So it is thrust upon people to capitulate to their politicized view, their religious zeal for homosexuality. And so the behavior, I don't care what you do. You know, I believe in free will. You ought to be able to choose whatever you want to do. You could choose to love whomever you want to love and play with whoever you want to play with and spend time with whomever you want to spend time with. I don't care. But when you take a sexual preference and you make it the sign, literally, just as circumcision is the sign of the covenant, you make it the sign of your of capitulation to your mindset, to your ideology, which is what homosexuality has become, then we have a real problem.
Right. And right, and the fact, actually, the fact that there's no tolerance of disagreement, and that anyone who disagrees that homosexuality is, say, in accordance with Yahweh's will, or advisable, or anyone who disagrees over these things is subjected to excoriation, ad hominem attacks, false allegations, defamation.
Glenn, I was flying on an airplane commercially a few years back. And I was having a conversation with the person next to me, and we were just talking about the news in general, and the big story was a gay marriage being legalized. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, what our positions are, and I said, listen, I don't care about if a person wants to be homosexual, I don't care who you love, who you spend time with, or any of that sort of thing. The thing that I don't like is, A, the politicizing of it to make it an esteemed act worthy of veneration. And number two, the political correctness making it impossible for somebody to even have a discussion about it. And the woman in front of us turned back and said, you know, I'm deeply offended by your statements.
Oh, that's you've learned that trick well.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Glenn, I would say that today, because of the universal indoctrination of so many people in the new seminaries of the ideology, political correctness, socialist, secular humanism, that because of the adherence and the growth and the age of the adherence and the thoroughness of their indoctrination and the fact that the professors and teachers are the most thoroughly indoctrinated of all of the adherents of this ideology. And that since they have turned the media into their mosques and churches, their places of devotion and worship, where they elevate individuals to star-like status, idols, if you will, using even religious terms in that regard, and that they have absolute, total control over politicians, regulating what they can say and what they can do. We probably are at a time where the integration of religion and politics is more extreme than it has ever been in human history. And you know, that's saying a lot when you consider Imperial Rome and Gnosticism, for example, and Greek thought and the Babylonians and their religious edicts, and Europe growing out of the collapse of the Roman Empire. That's saying a lot.
Yes, and there's more than one system of persuasion, more than one major religion. I mean, social secular humanism is certainly does seem to be the overarching one, which ultimately is involved with the deification of the self, and then you see, I would suggest there are even Luciferian ties in certain small cadres at the top of that.
Yeah, I would agree.
If you look at the tensions between, say, President Obama and Netanyahu right now, you see the role of, tensions with national Israel. We also have the lobbying efforts of groups like the ADL and stuff like that. And AIPAC and all that. So they're also players in terms of shouting people down and being influential.
Well, Christianity is certainly a player. I mean, Roman Catholicism is 1.2 billion people. Orthodox Christianity, 400 or 500 million people. Protestant Christianity, 300 or 400 million people. So Christianity is also a major player, and it's so interesting that you would have one of the most famous Christians in the world today, Franklin Graham, talking about the battlefield now being drawn between the advocates on one side, the sign on one side, the circumcision on one side, gay and lesbians against his religion, and the battlefield being politics.
And the Christians are so easily distracted into peripheral issues like that. If Christians were called to something, you know, of greater significance, like American imperial, military.
Manifest destiny, manifest destiny, and Christianity didn't work out so well for the indigenous people or the world at large, but...
Or even if they wanted to go after the Ponzi scheme of the central banking system, you know, things like that, and the usurious nature of that. There are all sorts of, or health care. No, what are they trying to mobilize the Christians to? A peripheral issue, you know.
But you know, it's interesting, of course, that the founder of Christianity, who was Paul, in his foremost letter, the letter that is the foundation for Christendom, Romans, that in Romans chapter 13, the heart of the book, Paul tells Christians that they must submit to their government, that the government has authority over them, and that the government is godly. Well, you speak of there's an element of Luciferian influence in the ideology of socialist secular humanism. Well, that's a satanic position there for sure. It's the very thing that Yahweh says you must walk away from before you can engage in a relationship with him. Paul wants you to devote yourself to and submit to.
Right. That's
highly Luciferian.
Oh, crazy.
By the way, the Luciferian influence is identified in really the founding charter of Adam Weishaupt, who created this monster that we consider today to be socialist secular humanism and its replacement moral code, political correctness. He called it the order of the Illumes.
Right.
The illuminated. And when, you know, Paul, for example, saw the flashing light on the road to Damascus, the Halal bin Shakar speaks of Satan's the adversary's nature. They are illuminated. It's just like the Freemasons. They ultimately see the illumination of Satan, of Halal bin Shakar. And they realize that in all of these human ideologies, it's Satan wanted to be cast as if he were God.